Today is Thursday, September 13th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, millions evacuate ahead of a life-threatening hurricane that's closing in on the southeast coast of the United States.
It is vital that every American in harm's way take this storm seriously and be safe.
Record heat and wildfires, a global problem made worse by climate change, bringing the game of soccer to refugee girls in America. And also ahead, what we've learned from Apple's latest product reveal. It's all on today's International Edition. Residents and businesses along the southeastern U.S. Atlantic coast are scrambling to put plywood over windows and being urged to finish preparations ahead of Hurricane Florence's expected arrival late Thursday or early Friday. Officials are calling Florence a monster, catastrophic event, the worst storm in 60 years, and an extremely dangerous major hurricane. It's expected to unleash damaging winds and life-threatening amounts of rain. Ed Rappaport is deputy director of the National Hurricane Center.
So there is a storm surge warning along the coast now for life-threatening storm surge. Again, this will be one of the key hazards for this hurricane.
South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster is urging residents to evacuate before it becomes impossible.
In fact, we'll start pulling all of the assets out of that at some time because even the rescuers cannot stay there and fight what is coming.
President Trump also sounding the warning on the urgency of getting out of the storm's path.
Get out of its way. Don't play games with it. It's a big one, maybe as big as they've seen, and tremendous amounts of water. The storm will come, it will go. We want everybody to be safe. We're fully prepared, food, medical, everything you can imagine, we are ready.
Well, Marshall Shepard is a professor at the University of Georgia's Geography Department and director of the university's Atmospheric Sciences Program, and also the former president of the American Meteorological Society. He tells International Edition's Sarah Williams about the unique qualities of this particular hurricane.
This hurricane is very difficult for us as meteorologists. I tweeted earlier that I've never seen anything like it in my 25 years as a meteorologist at NASA and now a professor at the University of Georgia. First of all, it's a fairly intense storm at a fairly high latitude, fairly north of the tropics. We typically don't see Cat 4, Cat 5 storms headed toward North Carolina. But recently, in the last 24 hours, the models have projected out a track forecast that's really unique. Many of us in our field have just not seen it. The model is bringing it into or very close to North Carolina, South Carolina border, and then shoving it down the coastline into South Carolina and perhaps into Georgia. That's very odd, but the steering currents are weak once the storm gets close to land, so it's not surprising if you think about what happens with a child's spin toy. You spin it around, it sits there and wobbles a while until something pushes it away.
I guess the last really powerful hurricane that hit in that particular area was Hurricane Hugo back in 1989?
I would say that Floyd and Matthew were pretty significant storms as well. Hurricane Matthew caused quite a bit of flooding in 2016 in parts of North Carolina. It came up from Florida. It certainly had weakened by the time it got to North Carolina some, but still was a significant hazard. But sure, Hurricane Hugo, in many people's mind, is the signature hurricane in the last 25, 30 years or so for that region. But I always caution against comparing storms. I mean, I've heard someone say, well, I wrote out Hugo, I'll be fine here. Every storm's different, and this one's very different from even Hugo.
What is the anticipated danger level to the population in this area as this, you know, hurricane approaches?
I think it's the highest level of danger I've seen with a storm. There are only certain storms that would make me say that. Storms like Maria approaching Puerto Rico, Katrina approaching New Orleans. I think this falls into that category because of the sheer size of the storm. It's physically huge. If you've seen satellite imagery, it's very strong. And more importantly, one of the things that worries me is that it's going to stall or slow down some right near the coast. And so there would be prolonged hours of rain, extreme winds, storm surge, and inland flooding and coastal flooding. So this is going to be perhaps a 1-2-3 punch, and it's not just going to come happen and move out. It may be a few days before we get rid of it.
I know you don't like comparing hurricanes, but I do remember that with Hurricane Harvey, that was also predicted to, you know, stall and linger.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I talked about Harvey last year, and I think sometimes the public struggles with the fact that you've got this 1-2 punch. I think people are very familiar with what happens to a storm when it makes landfall, very strong wind, storm surge, but that secondary part, that lingering around and producing days and days of rain and flooding, that's a bit more difficult for people to grasp the significant hazard associated with that. So, yeah, I think this is very Harvey-esque, but maybe actually in some ways a bit stronger and larger storm.
Well, authorities have called on people that are in the area that affected to evacuate. Is that something then you would agree with?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm always from the better safe than sorry school of camp. I don't mind being inconvenienced even if ultimately nothing happens. But I think in this case, with the size of the storm, you can't focus on exactly where it's going to make landfall because it's so big and has widespread impact. So I think responsible evacuation. And honestly, I think as I mentioned, there's been a recent sort of nudge or shift in the track that brings South Carolina and Georgia more into play a little bit. I think people in those areas have to kind of put their guard up as well, because perhaps many of them had written it off as, oh, it's going into North Carolina, I don't have anything to worry about. I think anywhere from Virginia to the Georgia coastline needs to be on alert and starting to make preparations, because this thing is big and it's powerful.
Well, I'm here in D.C. right above Virginia, so anyway.
Yeah, I'd say what I mean by Virginia is primarily the southern Virginia coastline areas. Not so much. I think the D.C. area will perhaps feel some residual rain or perhaps, but I think we're talking more about coastal Virginia southward down into South Georgia and perhaps parts of North Florida. But it's a storm to be reckoned with, and I think that I'm a little concerned, because one of the things that I always see is that people will see a forecast and say, oh, that's it. But with meteorological forecasts, you've got to watch the evolving forecast, because with these things, there can be changes. So people tend to kind of see what they saw on Monday and say, oh, that's what's going to happen. But with a storm like this, you've got to watch how it's evolving.
All right, that's Marshall Shepard, professor at the University of Georgia's Geography Department. U.S. Homeland Security officials are downplaying the transfer of nearly $10 million from the U.S. Disaster Response Agency to immigration enforcement efforts, first brought to national attention Tuesday night by Democratic Senator Jeff Merkley from the northwestern state of Oregon. He told a nightly MSNBC news program that the funds from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, were allocated for detention beds and transportation and removal by U.S. Immigration and Customs, or Enforcement, or ICE. Both agencies are part of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. DHS said the transfer of funds would neither affect FEMA's readiness for emergencies nor support immigration enforcement. The senator's allegations Tuesday hits the Trump administration on two of its more criticized policies, disaster preparedness and immigration detention. The U.S. government response to national disasters is under intense scrutiny after a study of Hurricane Maria deaths in Puerto Rico a year ago revised the original death toll, said to have been in the dozens, to nearly 3,000 on the U.S. territory. Joining us now is Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University. What's your take on this? Is it too much? Is it much to do about nothing?
I'm surprised that this was a surprise. The general rule is that if you're repurposing money, you need to alert Congress that you are doing so. So I'm wondering whether the senator somehow was not part of the committee that would receive this kind of notification. I don't quite understand that. But getting to the legal issue, the general rule is that money can be moved around with congressional authority, or that is, with a congressional notification, so long as it is money that falls into sort of the same general accounts. And I don't know how ICE and FEMA, how those accounts are handled. But generally, presidents have that kind of authority. What they don't have authority to do is move them between different accounts. For example, I'd be very surprised if you could repurpose DOD money, say, for missiles, and repurpose it for building a wall between Mexico and the United States. I'm assuming that was not done here. I assume that this that the repurposing of the money was done in accordance with the law.
Yeah, Merkley didn't say anything about it being an illegal thing.
Right.
I believe it is the White House's prerogative to be able to do this. He did call the transfer reprehensible. Of course, immigration advocates are saying it's alarming. FEMA,
sure,
though, in response, says that they do have plenty of resources to respond to this major storm. But, obviously, as we have this storm approaching and there's been a lot of controversy with the administration's immigration policies, there are still children that have been separated from their parents, despite a judge's order, still not reunited with their families.
Yes.
So it's just one of those things that's drawing a lot of attention.
I don't particularly have a point of view about ICE needing more money. But if it does, this is, in my view, a very clever way of doing it. Because what will never happen is if FEMA needs money for a disaster, that Congress will not provide it. In other words, if the problem is the loss of $10 million, which by and large is kind of chump change in the disaster area, but if they run short of money, FEMA will go to the Capitol Hill and get more money virtually overnight. And that's, for obvious political reasons. You just, congressmen from the southern states that are affected by this hurricane, they are needed, and there's an election coming up, and the states that are most likely to be affected are Republican states. So the last thing the president's going to want is to allow, and Congress for that matter, is to have FEMA short of money to help this important electorate.
Well, the document states that ICE won't be able to deport those who have violated immigration laws without this money.
Right.
And we know they've really stepped up their efforts to deport people who are in this country without documents or illegally.
Right.
Do you think that this is just sort of a Democratic effort to paint the administration in a bad light and
sure,
than it actually is an actual problem?
Yeah, of course it's. Look, we're 2 months away, less than 2 months away from a very important election, and everybody recognizes on both sides of the aisle, the Republicans and the Democrats and the president, that this is an incredibly important election. That's why nobody's going to have to worry about FEMA running out of money. On the one hand, and of course the Democrats want to make it seem as though the president is shortchanging the emergency funds. And I think both sides are playing this as for its worth politically. I don't think in substance it matters a whit.
All right, that's Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. President Trump authorizes additional action against election interference by foreign countries. The U.S. median household income reaches a record high. Climate change said to be fueling California wildfires. And Apple unveils larger iPhones and health-oriented watches. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, while the East Coast deals with the threat of a dangerous hurricane, California has experienced record heat waves and catastrophic fires this year and in previous years, leading climate experts to say it will likely get worse. A recent state report blames global climate change, and California Governor Jerry Brown is preparing to host an international summit later this week to search for solutions.
California's raging fires, the worst in the state's history this year and last. The 2018 Mendocino Complex fire alone scorched 186,000 hectares. Parts of rural California are still burning. It's a global problem made worse by climate change, most experts say, and the effects are not subtle.
We are literally seeing them play out in real time in the form of record heat waves, floods, droughts, and wildfires.
Climate researchers say worldwide emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases accelerate global warming. President Donald Trump is skeptical and announced the withdrawal from the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement, which aims to reduce emissions. He says the pact is ineffective and kills jobs. But climate researchers say something must be done to minimize the changes already underway.
A warmer atmosphere can hold more moisture, so there's the potential for greater rainfall events, worse flooding.
At other times, it leads to worsening fires and drought, a process the scientist says is fed by global changes to the Earth's wind patterns in the jet stream. All this has health effects, from pollutants emitted by fires to intense warming in the cities.
There's a larger population living in urban areas, and actually, more importantly, a larger vulnerable population living in urban areas.
Researchers are already seeing more emergencies and deaths among the very young and elderly and poor. Higher temperatures, reduced water supplies, flooded highways, coastal erosion, and serious fires can be expected if nothing is done, says a recent California report.
State and local governments and other players are taking this seriously, and I think that trend will grow as climate change symptoms continue to bubble up.
An international summit in San Francisco will examine ways to reduce emissions and avoid the worst-case scenarios. But protesters who have gathered there say it is not enough. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hey there, this is Shauna Renee, the lady DJ and host of Soul Lounge. Every Sunday at 1400 UTC, I choose an artist that you and I love, and we break down their entire career while listening to their biggest hits. That's what we do here on the Soul Lounge. Once again, every Sunday, 1400 UTC, right here.
VOA News.
VOA. When news breaks, VOA News is there. Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues.
Believe in something, even if it means sacrificing everything.
On the 30th anniversary of Nike's Just Do It slogan, the apparel and footwear company announced a new endorsement deal and ad starring former NFL player Colin Kaepernick. Kaepernick's decision to kneel in protest of police brutality during the national anthem at National Football League games has sparked controversy across the United States, with the fallout further blurring the line between sports and politics in America. The ad itself has also raised controversy, with critics saying Nike weighed into politics more than it should have. Vera Bumpers, chief of police with Houston Metro Transit and president of the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement, or NOBLE, joins us now to discuss. So what do you think this ad has, why do you think it's drawn so much division?
NOBLE is supporting because we believe that individuals have the right to peacefully protest under the First Amendment. And by doing that, I think they have brought awareness to some really important issues in our society right now, such as criminal justice reform and police and trust legitimacy. And so our focus is more on the cause that is bringing awareness to versus the person.
Why do you think that Nike got such backlash over this? Do you think Americans don't understand the reasoning behind the kneeling to some degree, that they think it's unpatriotic, as the president describes?
I think the backlash comes from focus of 2 years ago. He was in the NFL, the Sox, the kneeling. I think there was so much focus on that and making that a negative. We live in a great country, and what makes it great is that we have rights and those First Amendment rights to speak out on issues, and he chose to do his by kneeling. I think that when we focus so much on the kneeling, we lose sight of the issues, and I think we should, of course, we all are patriotic and support the flag, but we still have these issues that are pressing.
Well, we certainly have heard of many situations where an African-American young man has been shot and killed by a police officer that maybe unnecessarily, in many of these cases, according to a lot of reports, you know, African-Americans still believe that they are being profiled. And my understanding is this kneeling campaign, this kneeling protest is a way to bring awareness to what African-Americans see as profiling by law enforcement. Is that what you understand it to be? And if so, as someone who is a law enforcement official, do you believe that it is the case that African-Americans are still profiled?
I think that definitely this has brought awareness, gotten many of us to talking. First of all, Noble has been around since 1976. And Noble was started because of injustices and inequalities in our community. So this is nothing new for Noble as an organization, as many other organizations that care about what is going on in our communities. Even though we're police officers, we're also citizens. We live in the community. We have relatives. I'm a mother. I have a son, nephews, nieces, friends. So we all... Sometimes I think people forget, you know, we are the community also, and we see what is going on. So we're committed to this profession, though, and our commitment as law enforcement officers, we took an oath to serve and protect, and that means whether we agree with people or not. And I think that way, again, that was his way of bringing attention, but our focus, again, is going to be about building bridges and what can we do to improve this profession. And so we're looking at things that we can do, such as looking at criminal justice reform, sentencing reform, working with Congress people, persons to see if there's legislation that can be brought forth to improve. And not only that, maybe looking also at our training. What can we do in our individual agencies to improve? We have great law enforcement officers, and when one incident occurs, a negative, there should not be a blanket over all law enforcement. Talking about men and women who every day put their lives on the line and are serving and protecting.
What do you say to people who criticize the kneeling as unpatriotic? Kneeling during the national anthem is unpatriotic.
What I say to those people is that's an individual decision. That does not affect, should not affect how other individuals react to the flag. Being offended is a choice, and what people do, it's a choice. Every day we have choices. Again, people say and do things every day that we can say, you know, that is so offensive, or that's hurtful, or, you know, I'm so upset about it. But do you hold on to that, or do you say, you know, I don't think it's right, but that's not what I choose, and that's not what I'm going to teach my children to do. I'm going to find a way to make a positive impact.
All right, that's Vera Bumpers, Chief of Police with the Houston Metro Transit and President of the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement. Well, Apple announced new models of the iPhone and Apple Watch Wednesday at their 2018 launch event in Cupertino, California. Three new iPhones were introduced during the event, as well as a new Apple Watch, which will feature a larger screen and a slimmer case. And also, a trove of medical services, from detecting dangerous heart conditions like atrial fibrillation to giving wearers electrocardiograms. VOA's Victor Beatty talks to Tom Forte, Managing Director and Senior Technology Research Analyst with investment banking firm D.A. Davidson, and he gave his assessment of Apple's latest unveiling.
There's two things in particular that stand out to me. First and foremost, the XS and the XS Max have starting price points at essentially $1,000 U.S. and higher. And I think the lesson that Apple learned last year with the 10, if you have a price point north of $1,000, you can sell a lot less units and still bear the financial fruit of the product. So I really think that that's one standout. The other one is, I think the exercise for investors today was to watch the product unveiling and ask themselves, in particular on the Apple Watch, if they're offering the product at $399 and it becomes affected, meaning the price becomes affected by the tariffs that the U.S. government is imposing, would I still buy the product if it were 5 to 10% more expensive. So 5% on $400 is $20. So at $429 or $449, would I feel the same way about the Apple Watch? And I would argue that the elasticity in demand for the Apple Watch is greater than it is for the iPhone. So I think the big challenge for Apple going forward is, will there be some sort of degradation in their sales if these tariffs affect the price of their merchandise, especially on a short-term basis, the watch, and then on a long-term basis, the iPhone?
So what's Apple's strategy going forward here with these new products?
Apple's strategy going forward, I think, is to continue to dominate the high-end luxury portion of the category that it focuses on. So in the smartwatch, it's the high end of the category. In the smartphone, same thing. So I think Apple's core strategy is not to do everything, not to focus on every opportunity within consumer electronics. However, when it finds something worth pursuing, to go after the sweet spot for Apple, which is the high margin, high price point product.
One analyst suggests that this new unveiling will keep Apple's smartphone growth going until the competition steps up.
Absolutely. And I do think that on a near-term basis, so long as they can avoid the negative impact of tariffs on their primary product being the iPhone, then the future is bright for Apple and for the shares of Apple. And in particular, they're benefiting from the significant changes in U.S. tax law, which is enabling them to return more money to shareholders via buying back stock and via dividends. So on a near-term basis, I think the future is bright. At the same time, I think investors have to keep a close eye on the tariffs and seeing if that has an impact on their pricing or their margins on a near-term basis for the watch and then further out for the iPhone.
Is this an opening salvo to its competition?
Absolutely. And I do think that from an innovation standpoint, now that they have multiple phones with the facial recognition, including the XR or the 10R, the lower price model, and now that they have a phone with the facial recognition and a larger screen, what they're calling the Max, which in the past they had called the Plus, I do think that that puts them in a very good position versus the competition. And I do think that they have other innovations that necessarily didn't come out today. For example, I think their earbuds were one of their most popular products last year. And I fully anticipate that when they have the next generation of tablet, they may also get rid of the earplug jack and employ the earbuds as well, and then also have facial recognition instead of a home button on the screen.
Apple's still the trendsetter?
It is, within the smartphone category and within smartwatches. That said, I do think at some point in time, they need to fortify their products within connected home. Because I do think in the future, there will come a time when the smartphone will not be the hub in a hub and spoke model for the connected home. I think when everything is connected, then the significance of the smartphone is much lesser than it is today. So in that regard, I'm looking for Apple to advance its efforts in hardware in the smart home. I think the HomePod is one opportunity. Still a lot of improvement to be had there. And I'm still looking for Apple to either come out with a product or via M&A to mirror what Amazon is doing with Ring and what Google is doing with Nest.
All right, that's Tom Forte, Managing Director, Senior Technology Research Analyst with the investment banking firm D.A. Davidson.
This is Science in a Minute.
Beer is one of the oldest and most popular beverages in the world. While it's difficult to pinpoint exactly who was the first to brew the frothy concoction, historians generally agree that the brewing and drinking of beer and similar drinks can be traced back to about 5 to 7,000 years ago. U.S. and Israeli scientists say they have found evidence that suggests beer was brewed in the eastern Mediterranean area several millennia before that. The researchers from Stanford University in California and the University of Haifa in Israel studied and analyzed three stone mortars that were found in an ancient burial cave site in Israel. They say their analysis confirms that the mortars were used for storing food and for brewing a wheat barley-based beer that was probably served at ritual feasts some 13,000 years ago. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.